At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome, everyone, as always, to our September 2025 FOMC panel. Now, up until this point, since our last panel, the economy is giving us a bit of a mixed bag. We've got rebounding GDP in quarter two, but inflation kind of remains stickier than anyone was hoping for at this point. The labor market's cooling, and markets in general are trying to read the Fed's mind while balancing sheets and bond yields do their own thing. The housing market in general is still pretty pricey, and consumer spending shows resilience, but it's kind of uneven depending on which sector you're looking at. And we're still dealing with the global factors from trade friction to energy volatility, keeping many on edge. So today, if we can't predict the markets, we'll at least, by the end of things, be able to agree that nothing says fun like reading a yield curve for entertainment. Now, with that said, I'm going to jump into some introductions for our speakers today. As always, we're welcoming back our go-to Fed guy, Joseph Wang, formerly headed the trading desk at the Fed's Open Markets Desk, and has the same great introductory book to central banking I like to plug at the top of every panel, called Central Banking 101, and he's also the CIO at Monetary Macro. Welcome back, Joseph.
Hey, Nicholas. Hey, Neutral Wells. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here with my fellow friends and panelists once again.
Up next, joining us today, we've got another long-standing friend of the show, Last Bear Standing, expert on markets, and he also writes about monetary policy and stocks to watch in his weekly Substack. If you're not subscribed to that, go do it now. Welcome back, Last Bear. Joining us today for the first time in what seems like way too long is Johnny Matthews, our incumbent super macro man of the Twitter space and beyond. He has over 25 years of experience in investing and trading under his belt, with about half of that time spent with a macroeconomic focus as both Solomon Brothers and Brevin Howard. Currently runs his own site, blog, and service, Super Macro, constantly publishes in-depth market analysis and economic developments that affect the macro landscape. Welcome back, Johnny. Good to have you again.
Hi, Nicholas. Thank you. Thank you for having me back on the show.
Another joining us after quite some time off. Really happy to have you back as well. Martin Peltier, the portfolio manager at Trivest Wealth Council and an often columnist for the Financial Post and an avid skier.
Bonjour from Canada. Let's huck and pray.
Welcome back, Martin. So I'm going to throw us right to the wolves today. The CME FedWatch tool indicates, I think last I checked, was a 96% probability of a 25 basis point rate cut at the September FOMC meeting today. And the market's kind of anticipating two cuts by year's end. However, as a bit of a caveat there, Morgan Stanley suggests that the strong GDP growth we've seen and stable financial conditions might actually reduce the urgency for a rate cut, noting that the market odds of cuts could be closer to 50-50. So, Joseph, who's right? And does the Bank of Canada's cut this morning affect anything?
Well, first off, I'm going to have to leave the Bank of Canada with Martin. That was definitely very interesting that happened. So I think today, as you noted, Nicholas, between today and the last time, we've had data that hasn't really agreed with the Fed. On the one hand, the employment data has been weaker than expected. As we've all heard, the revisions in the job growth have been disappointing. And on the other hand, inflation has also been pretty disappointing as well. If you take a step back, you'll see that inflation has basically been stuck at 3% this year. And looking forward, it looks like it's going to be around 3% for the coming months as well. So basically, we're stuck. And so the market is pricing in 25 basis point cut today. Chair Powell telegraphed that very well at his Jackson Hole speech. But I think what is really interesting today is that we want to see how the Fed is looking at the next year and the year after that, because right now there's a huge disconnect between what the Fed telegraphed through its dot plot in June and what the market is pricing in for next year. The market is basically thinking that the Fed is going to go all in on the employment mandate and be cutting pretty aggressively. But that is not what was telegraphed in their June dot plot. And this meeting is a dot plot meeting, so we'll get to know more about that now. And of course, we also have some interesting politics on the committee. We have our distinguished FinTwit alum, Steve Moran, joining as Governor Moran and voting, and probably going to want to have more than 25 basis points. And we also have Governor Cook, newly restored by the appeals court. And it would be really funny if she voted to hike, but I don't think she's going to do that. So we'll get to see what happens with all that today as well.
Thank you, Joseph. And he did do a little bit of a shoulder tap right at you, Martin. I'm curious for your take here. Does the Bank of Canada's cut this morning affect anything that the U.S. Fed will do moving forward?
I think it's the other way around. We tend to follow the Fed, and given the confidence of that rate cut in the U.S., it bolstered a move by the Bank of Canada to follow suit. Currency is always of the utmost importance here, especially with trade and us importing a good chunk of goods, majority of our goods from the U.S. Canada is in a real big trouble economically. It's a huge dichotomy between the Canadian economy and the U.S. economy. You got unemployment at over 7% in Canada. Among young people, it's like 16%. We flooded the country with immigration and temporary foreign workers, and young people have no work. And so economically, GDP growth was negative in Q2. So there's quite the difference between Canada and the U.S. So I wouldn't be looking to Canada as to what they do. Thankfully, we're going to see some rate cuts in the U.S. that allow the Bank of Canada to continue to cut here.
Thank you, Martin. So kind of continuing down this line, just taking a little peek at that GDP figure, GDP rebounded at a 3.3% annualized rate in quarter two after a 0.5% contraction the prior quarter. And the Atlanta Fed GDP Now model estimates 3.4% growth for quarter three. And so my question here, I'm going to toss this one at you, Johnny. Is this strength promising in the mid to long term, or are people reading just too much into it too early on?
No, I think it is reasonably promising, actually. If you look at what caused the Atlanta Fed GDP to move higher, we had very strong real consumption in July. If you look at real consumption by months throughout this year, it's pretty much flatlined around a volatile trend. And, June, the level of real consumption in June was, I think, was about the same as in December. July was the first month where it really moved significantly in December. So we finally starting to see some real consumption growth. We've just had retail sales for August, and they were much stronger than most analysts expected across every aggregate, at the core, at the headline level, even in discretionary, the only glimpse that we get of discretionary services in the retail sales numbers, dining out at restaurants and bars, that was incredibly strong as well. So, it looks like the two of the 3 months of the current quarter are strong as far as consumption is concerned. Also, we've had the July figures for durable goods orders. They were also very strong. Core durable goods orders started the quarter on the front foot. And those were a good proxy for real business investment spending. And those are the two key components really lifted up the Atlanta Fed GDP Now forecast. So to me, it looks like growth, it's not falling apart. The US economy is doing okay. And obviously the labor market is weaker. It's weaker than we thought it was, in fact. We had the downward revisions to job growth. But the labor market isn't falling apart. you know, unemployment, I think it's been in a 4 to 4.2% range since May of 2024. It ticked up to 4.3% in all. That's still pretty low. And so I think as far as the Fed is concerned, I mean, the Fed would never really sacrifice the labor market just for the sake of getting inflation all the way down to 2%. The Fed is concerned about a pace of job creation that we've seen in recent months. So they're going to cut. There's no doubt about that. But I just don't think the economy is falling apart. And I certainly don't think, you know, we're heading into a recession or anything like that. I think the Fed easing policy will help support the market. And I think things are not too bad for Q3 and probably the same kind of thing for Q4.
Thank you, Johnny. Last Bear, I know you've had some combat going on with Twitter this morning. I'm just glad it's not me this time. Do you have anything to comment there? Do you agree with Johnny's take, not necessarily spearheading into a recession, and kind of on his take on the read of GDP currently?
Yeah, so I think a couple things that I would point out. I think one, obviously, the retail sales numbers that came out yesterday, I think, was a point that got a lot of attention around sort of a re-strengthening of consumer spending. The one point that I would add to that is that is a nominal figure, and it's possible that we are starting to see some impacts of tariffs kind of come through in terms of consumer prices and ultimately nominal, you know, retail spending, to the extent that things are just costing more and volume hasn't dropped, you know, accordingly. So I think that is like just at least an asterisk on that data point. I do think overall that we have seen a little bit of a rebound, I think, in consumer spending. Consumer has been, I'd say overall GDP numbers this whole year have been kind of strange with, you know, at the start of the year, there was all the noise around imports and gold movements. There obviously still is a lot of noise around imports and exports and how those have kind of fluctuated up and down this year. Could the consumption element, which is obviously the biggest component of GDP, has looked weaker this year? I think the prior two quarters was around 1%, whereas in much of the last 5 years, it was averaging around 2%. So definitely it's seen real slowdown despite sort of the noise and the overall headline number. I think right now the Atlanta GDP tracker, you know, shows consumption a little bit less than 2%, so maybe a little bit of an uptick since earlier this year. I definitely feel that, you know, it feels reminiscent, obviously, that the timing almost exactly a year ago. If folks recall, we had a number of poor labor market reports in the summer of last year, kind of culminating in a real growth scare for the market, or at least a sort of temporary one. That was when the Fed cut by 50 basis points and a little bit of a surprise last September. I don't know that 50 is on the table. People don't expect that's gonna happen today, but I think it is in some world a possibility. And then we saw what happened after we saw those rate cuts last year, where there was sort of a rebound in job activity. All of a sudden, the economic numbers started to turn up again. Whether or not that was directly a result of you know, the Fed's cuts or whether that was just sort of coincidental, I think is sort of an open point. But it's clear that there's pressure from the executive branch to lower interest rates. I think housing clearly is one of their top priorities, and they're making it, you know, a big political issue to try to lower mortgage rates and get housing restarted. Given who's in the White House and who's, you know, heading like the housing organizations at the federal level, obviously a lot of real estate guys who are very concerned around mortgage rates and probably see sort of the worst parts of the real estate market for, you know, home builders, which I think there is a significant overhang and significant sort of market dislocation there that doesn't look to be resolving in a positive way, absent sort of changes in policy levels. So I think there's a big pressure from the executive side. I think because of the recent weakness in job activity, the Fed will be much more inclined, feel much more comfortable cutting. At the same time, I wish Bob was on the panel, because I'm sure that he would have already mentioned that it's been however many quarters, I don't know, five years since the Fed has actually been at its target level in terms of inflation. And I think it feels like a situation where the Fed market sort of has kind of just accepted that 2% goal is not really a goal that anyone is looking to achieve, and that something less than 3% seems to be acceptable to the Fed to begin to sort of stimulate, despite really not achieving. I think on the long end of the yield, spins around really a longer term perspective as to what this new flexibility and then target really mean, and the fact that we're sort of stimulating into a situation where we haven't even seen annualized inflation reach a 2% target is obviously not on a positive in that respect either. So basically, I guess I would say short term, it seems pretty clear the Fed's path, and the market is pricing that with a high degree of confidence here today. And we'll have to just keep.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Keep looking to see if how that rebounds through the real economy in the coming months.
Thank you, Last Bear. A ton to unpack there, and you touched on a lot of the topics that I'm going to be bringing up later on in the panel as well. But one thing I wanted to tickle to the panel first is there at the top, you mentioned the retail sales. So I want to dive into that a little bit more. Those rose by 0.6% in August, which many say are mostly driven by autos, apparel, and dining, despite that elevated inflation metric. And so I wonder, what does this say, if anything at all, about current consumer resilience with their consumer spending? And are there any risks of a slowdown in the second half of the year, as many pundits have hinted at? Let's go, Joseph, on this one. And anyone on the panel, please, if you have anything to comment on what's been said so far, feel free.
So I think the Last Bear made a really good point that part of the nominal sales data, nominal retail sales we see, could be due to inflation. Now, one way to look at that is to look at real personal consumption expenditures for the past. You can see real PC has basically been flat for the past few months. So that tells you that a lot of what we see as, you know, sales gains is just inflation. And so from a real basis, the economy had, in terms of this consumer stuff, hasn't really been growing that much. So whether or not things will get better, Johnny mentioned, it seems like there are some bright spots in the economy. And so maybe things do get better. Atlanta GDP now is showing, say, over 3% growth. But I personally am pretty skeptical of that, because in order to have growth, you have to have more people working, right? And the jobs data is just not very good. The slowing down, the number of jobs created is very low. And that's just not consistent with these very strong GDP estimates that we're getting from nowcasting. So I would actually think that there's a good chance that for the second half, it also is pretty slow. And of course, I think a lot of the retail spending is being financed by the very wealth boom we see in the equity market. And that could change, right? We have some news about NVIDIA this morning. And the market seems to be very strong recently. But, you know, if that changes, we would have people with a lot less wealth to spend, and that would really change the outlook for the coming months, I think, when it comes to economic spending.
Thank you, Joseph. Johnny or Martin, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'll jump in here. I think you have quite the dichotomy between demographics. You've got baby boomers that are spending like banshees on services. Services inflation, it's 3.6% versus goods inflation, 1.5%. They're spending a lot of money in travel related spending, lodging and transportation costs. I read that boomers are 159% more likely than average to book vacations spontaneously. And I was in Italy in June before the kids got out of school, and it was insane. Demographics was all baby boomers, and majority of them were Americans. And they were dropping €1,000 a night for hotels. And so I think you're going to have that skewing some of the data that we're seeing. And in reality, those on Main Street low income to middle income are suffering, they're hurting, and they haven't experienced the path through of tariffs as of yet, and they will. Farmers are complaining already from how it's impacting them, but you have a demographic that's skewing the market. That has all kinds of other implications, even in the sector as well. They're going to need lower interest rates to for people to buy their houses. You know, I read that in the next 10 years, you're going to have baby boomers have to, you know, offload a pile of houses. I put a tweet, 30 million to 6 million expect to exit home ownership. So it reminds me of the days when I was working for the investment bank, and they wanted me to buy stock that outsiders didn't want to buy at record high prices, and they wanted to load me up on low cost debt to do it. Thankfully, I said no. But you know, I think that's an important part to the story here.
One thing I would add to that is there was a report out by a guy called Mark Zandi from Moody's Analytics a day or two ago. And he came to the same conclusion as he came to a few months ago, that consumers in the top 10% of the income distribution account for almost 50% of total spending. And those guys are doing fine. You know, as Joseph said, household wealth reached a record, I think it was 170 trillion or so in Q2. And it's probably higher than because the market has continued to rally. So that you got 50% of consumer spending is going to carry on at the same kind of pace. The others, you know, maybe it will slow down. But just as far as the retail report is concerned, it's a mix of volume increases and price increases. And we don't know what that is until the real consumption data is released. But July's real consumption was a step up from what we'd seen in the first half of the year. And so now we have August retail sales, you know, in nominal terms, stronger. I'm just saying that on the face of it, consumption growth in Q3 looks like it's going to be quite a bit stronger than it was for the first half of the year. So I think Q3 GDP growth, maybe the Atlanta Fed is exaggerating the number, but it does look like it's going to be quite respectable. But just getting back to the point about labor growth, I do agree with Joseph. That is a concern. You know, in order to get economic growth, you need an expansion in the labor force and productivity gains, a mix of those two, and then you get, you know, real GDP growth. At the moment, I think we're getting quite slow labor growth, but decent productivity gains. So maybe the trend GDP growth rate has stepped down from what it was, 3%, you know, in the prior couple of years. Maybe it's stepped down to 1.5 to 2%, which would not be a disaster. And I think if the Fed cuts rates, well, they will cut rates today, but also if they signal a sequence of rate cuts over the next few months, perhaps, you know, perhaps the dot plots or perhaps the forward guidance points to maybe 50 to 100 basis points over the next 6 months or so. I think that will loosen financial conditions a great deal and you know, may go some way to supporting the labor market. Obviously, it's not going to help inflation. And as I think the last bear correctly said, you know, services inflation running at 3.6%, just as goods inflation starts to pick up, it's not looking good for inflation. But, you know, like I said previously, the Fed is now firmly focused on the labor market.
Thank you, Johnny. And I do want to dive pretty deep into the labor and housing markets in a bit here. But since we're still on this topic of inflation, real quick, we still do, as mentioned before, have that inflation running above target. We had CPI come in at 2.9% and core CPI at 3.1%. But what I really want to harp on here is whether or not the Fed might be underestimating sticky price pressures, because as some of you may know, the core inflation numbers don't always paint a whole picture. We're seeing significantly higher rises in the costs of things like necessities, including groceries. And so I'm wondering, how does the Fed kind of juxtapose between the two? And are the numbers we're seeing definitive of how things really are for the average consumer? Joseph, could you touch on that before we kick it around the panel?
Well, as our friend Bob would say, it seems like the Fed gave up on their inflation target, right? Inflation has been above target how many times? I don't think they've given up on their inflation target. And like Johnny mentioned, the Fed has always subordinated their inflation target to their employment target, right? That's just how the Fed acts as an institution over the past few years. And you can see that through the backgrounds of the people who sit on the Fed, right? A lot of people who focused on labor. I don't know if the labor market has cracked enough for them to just really just forget about their inflation mandate. But I think it is a problem in that there doesn't seem to be a path for inflation to get down. Like you mentioned, inflation, you know, over the past has been a little bit lower in part due to energy, but then you can't expect oil prices to just keep going lower and lower, right? Maybe they can. Maybe President Trump can keep putting pressure on Saudi Arabia and other countries. But I think there's a limit to that. Eventually, oil prices will go back up. And as the last speaker mentioned, we have tariffs coming through. And maybe if the dollar continues to weaken, eventually exporters will change their prices and we'll have that feed through as well. So there, if you look at, say, market-based measures like CPI swaps, inflation swaps, you'll see that the market also thinks that we're going to stay around here at 3% for the foreseeable future. However, though, what the Fed could say, and I think that's what they tell other people, is that if you look beyond that, say five-year inflation swaps, longer-dated measures of inflation, you can see that they're still pretty stable, around 2%, around where they were pre-pandemic. And so I think what the Fed is trying to convince themselves is that, you know, all this stuff, it's basically transitory. And if you look at all these other measures, you know, people think eventually we'll get back to 2%, which means we'll get back to 2%. And I think that's the narrative that they tell themselves right now. I don't think that's what's going to happen, but I think that's what could assuage their conscience a little bit.
Thank you, Joseph. Even though I do think you gave some of us a bit of whiplash PTSD with the transitory use of vocabulary. Martin, I know you might have something to say about this. You recently actually had a tweet about Canada's reporting and kind of that disconnect between what's reported and how things actually are. Martin, could you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, so households in Canada are very levered and more so than anywhere else in the world. And that is having repercussions. And that's forcing the central bank to act in ways that maybe we're trying to force it to that other central banks may not. There is asset inflation, and it applies both to Canada and the U.S. And my whole point and that I've been pounding the table on is, does Main Street need more asset inflation? They're not participating in the stock rally. They're not participating in the housing rally. And goods inflation is falling, but it needs to fall further. And so what we need to do is we need to have growth, stimulated growth among the working class. And that's a major issue in Canada, more so than the US, as I just highlighted previously about the unemployment differences between Canada and the US. And we have some serious productivity issues. Now we have a government, federal government that is signaling a huge turning point from the previous government in regards to stimulating infrastructure spending. And if that does develop into something, then accessing and tapping into our resources could really turn us around. But that is a long ways away, and we're still in discussions. And that's, you know, the main point is that Main Street is suffering more so in Canada than in the U.S., and the numbers are showing that, and so we have to be cognizant of the changes that are being made.
All right, so I'm going to spin us right into our new track. I want to look a little bit more at monetary policy here a bit ahead of the data drop. First off, John C. Williams recently emphasized that data dependency and the importance of it, and said that the Fed will, quote, adjust policy carefully to support maximum employment while keeping inflation itself under control. Now, given what we now know about labor markets, which again we'll dive deeper into here in a moment, how should we interpret this guidance in the context of what the Fed signaled so far? Joseph, can you start us off?
Yeah, I think, well, Williams just says boilerplate stuff, right? So I think people pay a lot less attention to him because he hasn't been, doesn't seem to have been too influential on the FOMC recently. But part of this is that from his perspective, he thinks that, you know, the public takes their inflation expectations from what him, a Fed official, says. So he'll always tell you that, you know, he's very careful about, you know, getting inflation under control and so forth. So it's kind of what he has to say. But I do think, though, that overall, the committee is still more deliberate and data dependent than the market perceives. So I don't think that they're going to go and telegraph a lot of cuts. I think they really are at a point where they do want to be a bit more careful and still keep some weight on their inflation mandate and are going to take this meeting by meeting without giving too much. So I think that's the thing, something that he always has.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
That's to say, but I do think he also means it this time.
Thank you, Joseph. More in line with that, Les Bear, you brought up earlier something that's, you know, fairly obvious with the relationship between the executive branch and the Fed, that the Fed, though Jerome Powell has said, and I would argue in a lot of ways demonstrated the separation of the two, the independence of the Fed, right? The Fed is inarguably under a lot of political pressure as a whole to act, including, you know, this upcoming rate cut that does seem overwhelmingly projected to occur today. How does this pressure, if at all, influence the markets and expectations for year-end policy even, especially if we see a shift in economic data in the coming months, as some have warned? Les Bear, can you give us a little stab at that one?
Yeah, well, I think it's even if we assume that Powell's going to, you know, serve out his term here, the expectation is that whoever is going to be nominated in next year is going to be somebody who's aligned with what the executive branch is looking for. And I think you already kind of see that. I mean, Waller's obviously been a leading figure. I think prediction markets still have him as the leading candidate. He was out in August talking at a conference in Miami, you know, talking about how we need to cut rates and how we need to do it. You know, there's enough data to do that now. We shouldn't wait. We should be proactive. You know, things in line with sort of the talking points of the executive branch. And maybe those are, I mean, he has expressed some of those views for some time. So I don't want to say it's exclusively sort of a pander to the upcoming sort of nomination, but I think that it's hard to ignore that those are just, you know, the realities of the world that we live in, and that there will be pressure, you know, especially for people who are looking to kind of step into that role, to be aligned with that view. So I think it's a situation where, you know, we pretend that it says as you know, as independent as we can, and some chairs probably are better at doing that. I think Powell at this point is you know, going to try to maybe as a little bit of a countermeasure to that, if he knows where this is going 6 months from now, regardless, he may simply try to toe the line as hawkishly as he can until then, just as a, you know, as a display of his own ideals or values, or, you know, trying to basically hold back against the impression that the Fed and his sort of final, you know, time with the Fed is succumbing to political pressure that's outside of where they should be from a monetary perspective. But going back to, I think, some of the comments that others made on the panel about the demographics, I think it is really important to keep those in mind. Obviously, we talked about Canada, talked about the U.S., but even if you look at things like the Michigan survey, I think they have one data series that's really interesting that shows consumer sentiment for people who own stocks and people who don't own stocks, which obviously is a pretty good proxy for wealth demographics as well. And it's no surprise that people who don't own stocks or don't own assets are as pessimistic as they've ever been in this sort of post-COVID era currently. And yet you see a pretty decent rebound in folks, over the past couple of months who do own assets and have seen the stock market rally from, a crash back in April to, back to all-time highs and seemingly going up every day. And so I do think that there is that wealth effect continuing to happen. Obviously, that's a wealth effect that's somewhat unstable because it's contingent on market prices, which we know can move around a lot, but definitely is a factor in this. I do also think to the pressure on lowering rates, it'll be interesting to see beyond the federal, beyond the federal funds rate, if the administration is able to sort of achieve things, particularly in the mortgage market, without, outside of the Fed. So, the administration's talking about bringing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac back public, to the public markets probably sometime later this year. Definitely thinking about how that could either through capital requirements, easing capital requirements there, doing other things that might help spur the mortgage market. There's even been some rumors about or speculation that maybe the Fed would continue to or actually restart MBS purchases, which I don't think is going to happen. But whether it's through agencies like Fannie and Freddie, having more latitude to sort of directly target the housing market, I think that that's going to be an area that will be continuously focused on from the executive branch and from sort of the administrative angle beyond the Fed.
Thank you, Last Bear. Especially on that note on the markets, I want to touch on that a bit before we dive deeper into the labor situation. As you mentioned, ever since, April, when we had probably the brunt of the more superfluous inflation ideas coming out of the executive, it has seemed like it's just been on a straight trajectory up day over day. I mean, the ES keeps hitting all-time highs, gold keeps hitting all-time highs. And so I wonder, I'll pick on you for this one up front, Johnny. Is this just like wishful thinking as we move forward into the year, as things with tariffs are kind of cooling down a little bit? Are they, pricing in more than one cut? Are we looking at a repeat of April and this is just kind of a frenzy to get in?
Well, I think, first of all, now that Moran has been sworn in, you've got three Uber doves among the governors. So you've got Waller, Bowman, and now Moran. So the composition of the Fed has skewed more dovish. And we're going to see that in the dot plot. We're going to see some low dots from those guys, and especially Moran, who knows where he's going to put the dot. So I think as far as the market's concerned, the market is quite convinced that the Fed is going to cut rates over the next few meetings, down to below 3% by the end of next year. In fact, that's what the market's pricing in. And of course, we don't know whether what Powell says at this in the press conference will endorse that. We don't know what he's going to say. We don't know how the market's going to react. But at the moment, that's the way the market is behaving. But it's also interesting that typically, the Fed leads and the other major central banks follow. But we're in an interesting situation now where the next move by the ECB will probably be a hike. The BOJ is still in a kind of very slow motion hiking cycle. And it is possible they could hike in October. The Bank of England is pretty much on hold now, probably until February of next year. So the US is kind of out on a limb now, is cutting against the trend in the other major central banks. So I think the dollar is very vulnerable. And, you know, as the dollar weakens, gold gets a lift. It's an alternative currency, if you like. The central banks are still accumulating tons of gold. So, you know, there really is a tailwind to gold as far as the equity market is concerned. And I've got to be honest, in my newsletter, you know, I write about, you know, the PE ratios and everything and how it looks, you know, very richly valued. But earnings growth was pretty strong in Q2. And it's, you know, if you look at revenue growth from most of the sectors, it's also pretty strong. Companies are still doing pretty well. So from a trading perspective, you don't really want to stand in front of that locomotive. And so I just think I've got a sneaking suspicion the market is going to see what it wants to see when this meeting is over. And we'll just push this trend further. And I do just want to say that a lot of clever commentators want to say, well, you know, it's already priced in, it's already gone too far, you've got to fade the move. Well, good luck with that. I mean, I'm not so sure that is the right thing to do the way things are at the moment.
We've certainly all been hurt before trying to short the top, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, very difficult to find a top in this market. And, you know, it just seems to have a strong tailwind behind it now with the Fed, the way things are. Plus, you know, the fact that, as everyone's said on this panel, you know, inflation really isn't properly under control. And equities have proved to be a very good store of value, a very good protection against high inflation over the last few years. Treasuries haven't. They've been terrible for the last decade. Gold has been great. Crypto has been great. So, you know, this is the environment we're in. And you know, you've got to be very brave to say, well, things are going to change now. You know, policy is not going to keep this show on the road.
Thank you, Johnny. I do want to touch a little bit on something Johnny said there as well, mostly relative to the strength of the dollar. That disconnect is sort of due, as many are saying, to expectations of diverging Fed policy, as Johnny said, relative to the ECB, to the BOJ, even the BOE now. Joseph, how is the Fed factoring this in, kind of seeing what other banks are doing? And I also wonder, on top of that, if you don't mind, is there a risk of unintentionally tightening financial conditions in the U.S. due to this disconnect with other banks?
So I think the Fed would just tell you that they do things for the U.S. and don't focus too much. And as Martin mentioned earlier, I think that is broadly true because the U.S. Fed is so large. It's mostly the other central banks that adjust with respect to the Fed. Now, on the dollar, though, in the U.S., the dollar policy is under the Treasury. So the Fed would not tell you that they're managing that. But when you look at what President Trump has when asked about it, there's a pretty memorable interview a few weeks ago when he said, you know, I got to say that a strong dollar is good. But, you know, when you have a weak dollar, that's how you make money, right? That's what all the other countries want. They want a weaker currency so they can make money. So I think the implicit policy of this administration is to have a weaker dollar. It's part of their plan to try to revitalize U.S. manufacturing. And a weaker dollar is kind of what you see. And if the executive is going to exert more control over monetary policy, which I think is the world that we're going into, the president is renegotiating, you know, international order and also renegotiating how institutions work within the U.S., then I don't think today, but going forward, as they have more influence over the Fed, you know, you probably have more cuts than you would expect, and that will continue to weigh on the dollar, especially as other central banks, like Johnny mentioned, are standing pat for the moment.
Does anybody have anything to add to Joseph's point? So now we got about 18 minutes until we at least get some numbers and dot plots. I want to start leaning into the labor and housing markets, even though it's going to spill over. We'll have our usual little pause to review the data. But for now, back on that unemployment rate, which ticked up to 4.3% in August, which, mind you, is the highest it's been since 2021. And wage growth itself has also been slowing down a bit. And I wonder, is this, it's kind of a loaded one, there's two parts, so if we have to double back, just let me know. But I wonder if this, combined with labor force participation among younger workers falling for two consecutive months, are these signs that the labor market's beginning to weaken meaningfully? Or are we looking at more temporary fluctuations, kind of the norm here? Let's go last, Bear, and then I'd like to hear from Martin on this one too.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep, can hear you now.
Okay. So on the labor market, I think it's just been, you kind of have to tell the story on a longer time frame, which is that we went from, you know, from COVID, you know, a ton of people sort of out of work, at least temporarily. And then you had this huge, huge snapback, part just, you know, restarting the economy partially from stimulus. And you had probably the tightest labor conditions that, you know, that we've seen maybe ever in the US and around the world. And so you are coming off this multi-year, probably 3 years now of softening labor conditions. If you were just to look at sort of a chart and see, you know, job growth, to see, you know, wage growth, all that kind of thing. So we had this extreme shortage that now what we're looking at is a much more normal and weakening labor market, but not one that sort of follows the typical trajectory that you see in sort of a more cyclical, typical recession, where you have, you know, it kind of slowly top and then it start to accelerate to the downside. What we haven't seen even now is like acceleration to the downside in terms of things like, you know, initial claims, or even if you look at like JOLTS job openings or Indeed job openings, they're getting softer, but they're not rapidly getting softer. The rate of change is actually slowing down. At the same time, I think this makes it really challenging to look at the labor market and understand what's happening, because there's no indication that the labor market has improved.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
All in the past 3 years, in fact, pretty much all signs say that it's gotten continuously, but gradually quite, you know, significantly worse, and continues to follow that trajectory. So if you look at things like non-farm payroll additions, or the ADP report, which I think with enough time sort of track each other pretty nicely, the trend is just unequivocally down. For, you know, the past 2 years, 3 years. So, and we saw the first negative report based on revisions that came in this summer on the official BLS report. You know, we're seeing that sort of go way below what was in sort of the pre-COVID time period in terms of sort of a normalized growing economy. And so we're kind of in this very tough situation where we don't really know what amount is sort of a normalization versus what sort of a cyclical turnaround or cyclical sort of a downturn. And at the same time, we have this massive change in labor dynamics with respect to immigration, where so much of jobs growth over the past 2 years, you know, I think we can very confidently say was driven by the huge levels of immigration that in many ways, I think, were allowed to happen specifically because of labor shortage concerns. And so that has come down to basically zero in terms of at least, you know, undocumented immigration starting earlier this year. And so in some ways, it's like you can't really have job growth if you don't have, you know, an expanding labor market. At the same time, unemployment rates may be more sort of caught intact just because of the fact that, you know, caught in place just because of the fact that it's not like there's a huge surplus. It's like we're bringing down the supply so dramatically that we're kind of, and maybe hitting sort of some equilibrium. And if you look at sort of foreign versus native born job, jobs, which is published by the Fed, you do see sort of a significant step down over the past couple months in terms of foreign born workers, which were driving most of the growth. And you actually see the opposite in terms of native growth. And obviously that's been the talking point of this administration going back to 2016. In some ways, you know, their policy, you could argue, maybe, you know, at least doing what it was intended to do in terms of shifting labor dynamics internally between sort of a more, native focus versus migrant workforce. And that all those things complicate the labor market really, significantly. So it's tough to say until you start to see like that cascading effect, that accelerating effect of, hey, job growth, initial claims are up and up and up and starting to get, starting to go parabolic up. We just don't see that yet. We don't see that in continued claims. We see ongoing weakness. So whether we're at the point where, we're waiting for the straw to kind of snap the camel's back, and that's still somewhere in the future, or whether we need to be sort of mindful about how this time period is quite unique and the labor dynamics here are very different than a typical recession, I think is the challenge that we as economic forecasters and certainly the Fed have to sort of take in mind as they're making these decisions.
Man, with what we've seen in the last 10 or so months, I think that camel's the strongest damn thing on the planet at this point. Martin, do you have anything to add to Last Bear's points there? Any disagreements especially? You guys know I love drama.
I want to get into the housing market and tie that
by all means, yeah.
Second part. Yeah, the second part of your question. So there's, a little bit of a dichotomy between Canada and the U.S., in the U.S., housing prices have been fairly resilient, and baby boomers are representing half of the purchases and sales, and 51% or 52% of boomers are using cash to buy houses. And with falling rates, the expectation is that and the stronger economy, that housing prices are going to go higher. And so that means there's a shortage of supply on the market, and that's going to continue to push prices higher with falling rates. And that's good for those who own houses, not so good for Main Street who don't, who are renting. And I saw a stat today and I posted it on, is that renting has never been this more attractive than buying in U.S. history. And so it's a good time for people to be forced into renting versus owning, but they really don't have a choice. In Canada, it's a different story. Housing prices are collapsing in the hottest regions. In Hamilton, for example, Ontario, you can Google that for the American listeners here. At one time, Google Hamilton, Ontario winter, and you'll get a snapshot. They have a good CFL team. But they, at one time, housing prices in Hamilton, Ontario were higher than San Jose, California. And that's correcting. We're seeing a material drop in those frothy segments from the COVID highs. Some of these prices are off 25 to 40%. And so that's going to create an excess supply, as if you think the price is going lower than higher, then you'll have more housing and you'll have more of a sell-off. And so that's going to create a benefit to the Main Street in Canada, because it'll be able to get into a home at a more affordable level. But having said that, there's a big gap between America and Canada on the average price and income. So right now in Canada, in Toronto, 71% of your income goes to servicing a house, whereas in other larger cities in the U.S., it's more like 40%. So that gap's got to narrow significantly. And so I worry that if the Fed cuts rates too aggressively, it's going to push housing prices even higher and narrow the gap between Canada, and that does nothing to help. Talking about labor statistics and numbers, that means nothing when you're looking at housing prices continue to push higher.
Thank you, Martin. That actually brings me to what I wanted to touch on with housing is even though we're looking at the lowest mortgage rates in the U.S. we've seen in like a hot minute, they're still extremely high, while affordability seems further and further away. I think Redfin reported that affordability based on income versus cost of home is at all-time lows since they started tracking the data. And so I do wonder, is there signs that this combined with weaker employment will spill over into the housing market and kind of spiral both of the situations into something worse than we're currently looking at? Johnny, do you have any insight on that?
Yeah, I want to make one point first of all. You know, when we look at U.S. house prices, we often look at the S&P CoreLogic indices. They are very lagging indicators. They're based off a three-month average of closing of home sales. You know, sales that were agreed a month or two prior to that. And it's reported with a 1 or 2 month lag. So you're seeing really prices from a few months ago. I do actually think the house prices in the US on average are coming down they're coming lower faster than it looks from those house price indices. But I think, you know, the problem is if the mortgage rate does drop a lot, then it's going to reignite the fire under the housing market. You know, it'll take off again. So, and I don't think that really helps the situation because, as I think most people on this panel agree, housing affordability is quite a challenge now. And the last thing that the younger demographic needs is to put home ownership further out of reach. So, you know, I think to sum up, I do think the house prices are heading lower, but I think a significant cut in the Fed funds rate that starts pulling, you know, mortgage rates lower as well, brings the whole treasury curve down, the belly of the treasury curve and the 10-year, if it comes a lot lower, mortgage rates drop, I think you'll get the housing market off to the races again.
I'll just jump in and add on that. You're much better to have a higher mortgage rate and have a house price that's a smaller percentage of your total income. We saw that housing in Canada was more affordable in the 80s when rates were in double digits. So, you know, would you rather have a house at a 10% mortgage and 3 to 4 times your income, or a 3% mortgage and 10 times your income? I agree with Johnny. You got to have some stability there. And if the prices are already starting to fall, and which I would agree they are starting to show a little bit of weakness. If that continues and mortgage rates stay flat, then maybe it accelerates and it creates even more affordability for Main Street. But the bottom line is it stocks and houses and boomers, baby boomers benefiting from rate cuts and asset inflation way more so than asset deflation and higher rates? That's the big debate right now.
We are, and I'm a boomer, we are what you call the hit and run generation. You know, we had the best of the defined benefit pensions, best of the house price appreciation. We had the best of everything. And it's too bad for the next generation. But I agree. I mean, I do remember a few decades ago buying a house in the UK as well. Was much easier, much more affordable. And that was when interest rates were at double digits. And you know, even at 8%, I remember getting 8%, locking in an 8% mortgage rate for 2 years and thinking that was the best deal ever. I agree. You're better off to have housing more affordable and higher rates than the situation that we've got now, where it's out of reach for the younger generation who just can't get on the housing ladder without a lot of help from mommy and daddy.
As a millennial, I'm stretching, man. I'm stretching real hard. I'm trying to get there. I'll reach eventually. Now, last bear, I want to tap your shoulder now that we got you back. Still on this same subject here of housing, builders are reporting slowing starts, even though a lot of those concerns around material costs and tariffs have kind of dropped significantly since, you know, their peak of uncertainty back in April. Are those slow starts in any way a leading sign of broader weakness or just kind of tied to, you know, current rate uncertainty?
I would say that, again, I've said this on multiple panels in the past, but in the US, you just have to, there isn't one housing market. There's basically two. You can cut the country in half sort of on a north-south basis for the most part with what's going on. So in the South, where you had massive price increases and a huge amount of like home build out in sort of the immediate COVID aftermath, you see markets that are now swinging back to oversupplied, to price cuts, to really negative builder sentiment. Whereas in the Northeast and in the North and Midwest, you still have prices growth. I think it's like, Hartford, Connecticut, Buffalo, New York, places in Wisconsin, you still see prices growing at like, I think it was 0.8% month over month that annualizes to like 10% a year. So in certain markets, there's just still zero supply. And in northern markets, there's basically no supply, and prices are still supported by that, because if you want to buy a house, there's no choice. And then in other parts of the country, you know, you're seeing sort of a more classic boom and bust sort of play out, and it doesn't look as good. But the risk with the Fed and sort of, you know, and the administration and pushing this is that not all the housing market in the U.S. needs stimulus. You probably have certain areas that, you know, which also were the areas where you saw prices increase by 50% over 2 or 3 years, starting to reset to a more normal level. And you have builders crying about, you know, about their margins, even though their margins are basically the same as they were in 2019. And starts, you know, even if they come down, they're not materially below, you know, they're significantly higher than they were in, let's say, 2013, or sort of coming out of the global financial crisis. So it's not crisis level for builders, even though it might seem that way from the peaks of 2021, 2022. And at the same time, you have so many parts of the country that are still totally dislocated and very, very seller friendly still. So if you push down mortgage rates, that's obviously, shelter costs is a huge part of inflation overall. I think that one of the biggest, I think what many people would agree is that one of the biggest failures of the Fed in the response to COVID was the degree of aggressiveness on buying mortgage-backed securities and pushing down mortgage rates in the way that they did, sort of creating this massive boom in housing prices, which now we all agree is a big problem because of unaffordability. When the Fed has tried to come into this housing market, again, like everyone's saying, they're favoring asset prices over sort of broader economic distribution. And obviously those assets are highly concentrated, both in the stock market, both in the housing market. And at the same time, not taking inflation down to 2% is effectively, you know, paying through it through a regressive tax of inflation. And that's much more broad based. It hurts people on the lower income spectrum on a proportional basis, much larger than on a higher basis. So, but that continues to be the policy. And it doesn't seem that there's a whole lot of will, even though you have a lot of young people starting to express their frustration, reasonable frustration, and starting to look to populist candidates on both sides of the aisle to sort of...
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's Upwork.com, Upwork.com.
Address these extreme inequalities, we don't see from the highest level that's something that's really being prioritized. So I know it's 2 o'clock. I'll pause there.
Thank you, Last Bear. And we'll definitely put a pin in that and come back to it, because we have a lot of interest to talk about in the housing market and the markets in general. For now, we did get that projected cut of 25 bips. So as always, panelists, speak freely during this little interim as you digest the data, as you digest the dot plots. I'm going to pause myself for a moment here while our experts take a look over things. and we'll get right back into it.
Well, I think the first two points to make is that the median forecast, the median projected rate is now for 75 basis points of cuts in, well, the current 25 and a further 50 by the end of this year. And that Moran dissented in favor of a 50 basis point cut at this meeting. So, you know, certainly the committee has skewed in a more dovish direction. And although the dot plots for further out, the median dot plot hasn't changed, certainly the way the committee is going by next year, who knows where they're going to take rates.
So, I mean, for next year, they're projecting 3.4, which is much higher than the market was pricing in, so 2.9. I thought that was a pretty big disconnect. So let's see how the market processes that. And also, I thought it was interesting that they revised next year's forecast for the unemployment rate a little bit lower and for inflation a little bit higher. So I think that's reflecting some of the things that panelists have noted. The economy so far seems to be doing better than expected over the past couple months, and inflation is very sticky.
Is there any indication that panelists are seeing based on the stickiness of inflation that, you know, the Fed might be still slow or fast, as some say? I know it seems to be pretty divided down the line how the Fed should continue moving forward. But I'm just curious, with this current drop, the current dot plots, how we're feeling about those projections later in the year.
I think the Fed believes that they need to get ahead of this cooling of the labor market and make sure it doesn't really crack. Because in the past, you know, you typically see things slow down and then suddenly it goes discontinuous. You know, you get a massive crack, layoffs spike, unemployment, you know, shoots up. We're nowhere near that, but the Fed wants to ensure that doesn't happen, or they want to try to ensure it doesn't happen. I think also the Fed believes that they know how to deal with inflation. If inflation becomes a problem further down the line, they know what to do. But for now, the labor market is a bigger problem. And also, you know, we've spoken about goods price inflation being pushed higher as a result of the tariffs. The Fed generally believes that it's a one-off price level shift, which in theory it should be. Although, you know, in the longer run with the administration's trade policies, you know, we've got this deglobalization effect, which will have some sort of longer lasting upward influence on goods inflation over the longer term. So the bottom line is, I think they just want to get ahead of the labor market softness and worry about getting inflation back to target, you know, at some future point.
I guess the question for me and for the panel is, when is that going to happen? Like, what's the structural change that's going to happen if you're unwilling to, even in a period of relatively, you know, period of strong economic growth, I would say over the past 3 years, that you're unwilling to sort of do what it takes to actually drive inflation down now. Now you're in a stance of, you know, calling for stimulus, calling for housing, you know, rate cuts. We're in this rate cutting cycle, and, you know, the federal deficit being structurally the way that it is with, you know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid payments, just demographics, just going to continue to expand at, you know, interest payments, you know, rapidly rising. There isn't really any meaningful cut to discretionary spending. And so where does that disinflation come from? It's not going to come from globalization. That's going the wrong way. Demographics are, you know, aren't favoring it either. So I think that's on the long end, that's kind of the bigger picture question, regardless of the fact that near term, you know, easier financial conditions are going to be good for markets and good for short term rates.
I think what you guys in the US need is your own Liz Truss moment, where the long end of the fixed income market just says enough is enough. That will probably, you know, focus the minds of the guys on the Fed. One other point I just want to come back to, you know, if we're looking at the, just to get back to the labor market, the revisions that we had to job growth took job growth down from an average of 150,000 a month in the year up to March to half that. And yet the unemployment rate was still in that 4 to 4.2% range throughout that point. And it kind of, it hints at the fact that you need to create fewer jobs to keep the unemployment rate low and stable, simply because, and I think it was Martin who mentioned this earlier, you know, the supply of workers has declined. Immigration has fallen to virtually nothing. The boomers are retiring and the supply of workers is much lower. So if that's the case, and you stimulate, if you do manage to stimulate the labor market and create more demand with a lower supply, it may well lead to wage rises. You know, and it's particularly while inflation is elevated and heading higher. You know, if the labor market does tighten again, workers have more power to command higher wages.
I think the US economy is so heavily financialized, and for Americans, the equity market is such a large part of not just what's on the news, but how they perceive their worth, their net worth, their financial well-being. And it's, you know, it's a publicly traded market. It's not like real estate. It's hyper liquid. It can change in value quite quickly. And so if you have a meaningful correction in the equity market, that negative wealth effect, I think, will go far in bringing down inflation, because everyone would just cut back so much, probably have a recession. And I think that will help a lot.
But I jump in. I mean, the market's got, being a daily participant, it's got so much liquidity, and it's factoring in the influence of maybe the Trump administration. And, you know, my tagline is cut the deficit, not rates. And you have a persistent fiscal deficit. You have monetary loosening that is expected to accelerate over the next couple of months. Markets are pricing that in, and it's going higher. And so I don't see any sort of meaningful correction on the horizon. I think we'll push through seasonality. And as a fund manager and an investment manager, I have to be able to participate in that while protecting against the downside. And so looking at the risks in itself, there's a lot of liquidity in assets and stocks are going higher, and that's going to maybe drive that inflation. This reminds me a lot of 1998, Fed slash rates by 75 bips. They're doing the same thing again. But 2 years later, we all know what happened. I do worry, and that's what keeps me up at night, the consequences of this. If we do have another, let's say we have another two more cuts and another, you know, four more cuts in the next 6 months, what are going to be the long-term consequences of that and the asset inflation?
I don't disagree, but I think, you know, just taking it one meeting at a time, you know, as far as this meeting is concerned, it's the kind of reaction that I expected. You know, the dot plot for next year, as Joseph mentioned, is 3.4% for the end of next year. The market was priced for a rate below 3%. It doesn't matter. You know, the Fed's cutting. They're probably going to cut again and again. And so you want to get out of the dollar. You want to get into gold. You want to get into other currencies where the central banks are going in the opposite direction, like sterling, like, well, we're on hold, but the euro, the yen. And this is just the kind of reaction that you're going to get from this. I don't know at what point it gets to such a ridiculous level that somehow there's some kind of disappointment. Maybe it'll be higher inflation prints that really force the Fed's hand, maybe stronger job growth and higher inflation prints that, and a sell-off at the long end of the curve, you know, that maybe suddenly cause a reassessment of the trajectory of Fed funds. Something will eventually happen to send this market lower, but at the moment, it's like I said, you just don't want to stand in the way of this freight train.
So all of that kind of begs the question to me in terms of trading, in terms of folks actively investing. Given this trajectory of all-time high after new all-time high, while Treasury yields are kind of, you know, they're kind of just fluctuating in response to economic data in general. You can correct me if I'm wrong there. That's just kind of how I've perceived it. Are markets, after today's cut, moving forward, have markets been pricing in the Fed's moves correctly, or are we looking, you know, at the potential for a sharp repricing of the markets, or even part of what Johnny fears, as he discussed earlier? Sorry, I didn't designate
I'll jump
that
in
anyone.
Here.
Anyone, feel free. Go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, I'll jump in. I think that bond markets are being more cautious in their forward outlook versus equity markets that are going all in. And so if there is any sort of impact on tariffs and we get some much needed visibility as to what they are and who the impact and everything else, and if some of that's going to get rebated to the consumer or not, there's just a lot of uncertainty, and the equity markets are factoring in a resolution to that and a continued boost in liquidity. Bond markets are not. So there's a trade there. I've said it as much in the near term. I think long dated treasuries are looking at somewhat attractive as a near term trade. But as a trade, I do like the cautious approach that bond markets are taking. And I think they'll adjust. But it is setting things up, you know, when everything's priced in and you're selling vol and picking up pennies in front of a steamroller. Eventually that steamroller is going to snag a piece of your clothing, and it's not pretty. So, you know, you just have to be cognizant of those risks. Absolutely.
So I have to ask, go ahead. Yeah.
So my view on the bond market, and I understand, I agree with all you guys, you know, it seems like the logical consequence would be for, you know, eventually you have some more risk in the long end and it floats higher. And globally, the long end has been rising higher. But then there's like an easy solution to that, right? Just have the Fed just do something, right? Say the president says, I think rates are too high. You know, you're my Fed chair. Do something for it. And I think that will do something. It's something they have a lot of control over. So it doesn't seem like that would ever be something that is a limiting factor.
So kind of dating back towards the top of the show today, we did have a tiny trickle in of discussion about earnings, and the trend has been pretty uppies for some of the big names. I mean, the NVIDIAs of the world obviously still staying on top. They have a lot of forward-looking guidance and in reactions to, you know, AI development. They're kind of the spearheading leader of that sector in units sold. But my question here is, how do we feel about the narrative around the current potential of a market bubble, that being AI? NVIDIA, I mean, it accounts for what, like 10% of the NASDAQ. What NVIDIA does, NASDAQ follows, unless there's some severe disconnect between the others within the NASDAQ. Is that bubble more or less convincing now than it was, say, 4 months ago when people were really starting to harp on it? Anyone feel
trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers,
At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Free to take that. Let's try to get Last Bear Buck up here as well. Looks like Last Bear dropped on us. What are your thoughts there, Johnny, while we try to get him back?
I've got to be honest. I've been so wrong about NVIDIA and what's going to happen to that stock. I'm probably not the best person to ask.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So, if anyone else wants to jump in, please feel free.
Yeah, so I've been super wrong as well. But I think it's a huge bubble. But the thing about it is that as I listen to people in the tech sector, they all freely admit, yeah, probably a bubble in AI. And we've all heard famous people talk about it. But I think the question really is just what inning are you in? And so for the people who are bullish, they'd be like, yeah, it's an AI. It's a bubble for sure. But, you know, we're in the early innings and maybe this becomes like, you know, 1999 and it just doubles and triples from now on. And if you are more bearish, we'd say like, you know, we're more towards the later endings of this. And so it could be over sooner. So I think that the debate really is that just where are we when it comes to this process? So personally, when I look at this, I think there's more awareness that there is more concern. And so we saw GPT-5 being quite disappointing. And also we're seeing some more competition both within the AI ecosystem. For example, let's say OpenAI working with Broadcom to compete with NVIDIA. And of course, all the hyperscalers have all their chips as well. We also know that their clients don't really make money, like all the AI startups and so forth. And we also have increased competition from abroad, as we've all heard today. You have China basically walling in their ecosystem and building their own competitors that they can sell throughout the world. So I personally have been very wrong in this, but I think we're much closer to the end than the beginning.
I think it's a good stock trader's market, and more so than ever. There's time to be passive and there's time to be active. Obviously, during the market corrections, you don't know what's going to rip first, so you want to own passive, high concentration. If you look at NVIDIA, two of its largest, you know, customers are also potentially on the, you know, 18% of the index combined with theirs. There's too much concentration in that space. You know, we bought Google, for example, and that's been a really good trade for us. So you can actually pick away at some of the names that are legitimately going to benefit from artificial intelligence that hasn't been fully captured in yet. Apple, for example, maybe. But there are opportunities. I think we've got another year or two left in this run, and now you have all indications that we're going to get much lower interest rates. And that's really good for those who are spending trillions of dollars on CapEx. Infrastructure spending alone was something 9 trillion last year and this year in data center infrastructure and AI related spends. And so the cost of capital for that is going to be significantly lower and falling. So that should continue to fuel CapEx spends. Having been in the oil patch for 10 years, I've lived through that. I've seen what happens when you have an irrational allocation of capital because it's so cheap and you end up spending a lot of money you probably shouldn't spend. And I think the same thing is going to play out in the AI space. There's going to be a misallocation of capital and some poor results. And it's going to take time for that to work its way into the market. There's going to be winners and losers. And those who are highly valued, the intrinsic value of that, it better, you know, value and judgment day better be there for the price that you're paying now. And for many companies, it's not. And so you got to have some exposure to the space. You face career risk as an asset manager. If you don't track anywhere close to the indices, you're going to lose clients. And you lose a lot more clients when markets are rocketing and you're not participating than you do if markets are correcting and you're participating. And I think that's going to continue to drive markets higher through the end of the year.
So I have to ask, I know we have about 10 minutes until Jerome takes the podium with either a good afternoon or a purple tie. I want to talk a little bit about something we talked about quite a bit, especially dating back to the days immediately post-COVID, and that being the inversion of the yield curve, which has sits uninverted. Is that uninversion in any way significant? Because my understanding is that, like inversion, uninversion of the yield curve, or I think sometimes referenced as the yield curve normalization, is a reflection of investors expecting the Fed to lower rates, which we did do today. But I do wonder if, you know, harping back to whether the Fed is above, behind the curve, playing catch up, is it really that significant of an indication that recession is no longer a tail risk as it used to be, or was, you know, the main tail risk of many conversations we had on these panels? Is that uninversion significant? Is recession canceled, or is the Fed again behind?
Well, I never believed that the inverted yield curve was going to lead us into a recession in the first place. And then the story became, well, ahead of a recession, the yield curve uninverts. You know, it goes inverted for several months, and then when it uninverts, when it disinverts, that's when the recession starts, and that signals, you know, the Fed is way behind the curve and they've got to start cutting aggressively. I think it is, it, you know, the yield curve just really signifies expectations of the future Fed funds rate. You know, the market's expectations of where the funds rate is going to go, and a bit of term premium and so on. I just don't think you can put together any sort of useful indicator of when a recession to start. I mean, for a while we had the SARM rule, didn't we? And you know, the SARM rule, Claudia SARM at the time, who came up with that rule, discredited the signal that it was sending. I think it was about a year ago. And since the SARM rule stopped signaling a recession, and of course we didn't have a recession, I think it's very, very hard to take any one, or you know, create a kind of designer index of recession signals. It's just really, really difficult to do that. And certainly the yield curve is not really going to tell you when a recession is going to start.
I'll jump in. I think the yield curve is not necessarily no longer a recessionary indication, but more so of global bond vigilantes. I don't know if that's the right term or not, pushing back against global deficit spending. The U.S. is still running a massive deficit akin to a financial crisis. And bond markets are holding them accountable. They're saying, you need to cut your spending. We are not in a recessionary type of environment. And the fiscal deficit that Trump promised to cut, to dodge or whatever you call it, just didn't materialize. And now they're saying, we want lower interest rates so we can keep spending like a banshee. That's happening globally. Governments need to stop their spending, and bond markets are going to hold them accountable. So I think the yield curve will continue to, maybe in the near term, like a trade on falling rates. But I think it's going to hold them longer term accountable. And unless they cut their deficit spending, you're going to see the yield curve look like what it has looked like for a while. And that means, you know, bonds are not the best type of long term as long as this continues.
Guys, if you look at the dot plot for this, and there are people posting this picture on Twitter, you notice for 2025, you have a whole bunch of dots clustered around, you know, 4%, 3.5%, and so forth. And you have one dot that is much, much lower than everyone else, who's basically cut 50 basis points every meeting this year. And I think we all know who that is. And so, you know, going forward, there's probably going to be more people who kind of take, who view monetary policy through the lens of the executive. And so, you know, maybe the yield curve is just going to be what the politics is, as rather than some kind of signal of anything else.
Last bear, I saw you had also that. Yeah, hit me with it, last bear.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add that the one thing that I think has changed over the years and versus prior cycles, first of all, this cycle, past 5 years or so, has been very extraordinary for a lot of different reasons that make it harder to compare, but also just the level of Fed intervention, forward guidance, the level of, you know, fiscal spending being a key driver of economic growth and fiscal sort of deficit spending, as opposed to more private sector. Like, the private sector has been delevering while the, you know, the growth and credit has come mostly from the public sector. And so that changes the dynamics of probably how interest rates flow through the economy. And like we said, we're in a very much a fiscal powered type environment here. At the same time, we have a Fed that has shown, especially, you know, in prior last couple of years, that it can and will be very interventionist to the extent that things, you know, to get the outcome that they want. And so I think that there's, you know, there's just a lot more noise now than maybe there used to be. At the same time, I would say that, you know, the if you look at three month versus 10-year, that's just kind of been just at zero, basically flat, for the past couple months, most of this year. You do have reversion, sort of normalization on the 2-10, that seems to be going higher. I do think that what we do see across the yield curve is that medium-term interest rates are perceived to be much more influenced by the Fed and the Fed's decision, regardless of what happens longer term. And we see those, see those coming down in line with where the Fed wants them to be. But on the longer end, especially ultra-long sort of 30-year rates, the trend is not going down, it's going up, and it continues up, probably across sort of like G7 markets. And I think that there's that sort of disconnect between, hey, here's what the Fed can control, here's what is likely going to happen next year, and how to position forward on the short end, is increasingly divergent with sort of the long-term picture, which is the, you know, barrier picture that people don't really want to address. Politicians certainly don't want to address structural changes to the budget that hit entitlements, that sort of thing. But those are sort of the big questions that it's never a good time to answer in the short term, but are going to continue to drive outcomes on the long end of the yield curve.
Beautifully said. We've got about 2 minutes left before Jerome takes the presser. I want to take a quick moment here at the end, just thank each panelist that we have on these. This one was a small but mighty panel. I always learn a ton of shit on these. Can't thank you guys enough for being here. Let's go ahead and run down the line for some super quick final thoughts. And if you got something to plug, please do. Joseph, start us off.
Well, thanks so much for coming here. Always learn a lot. Glad to hear all these different perspectives. Definitely makes me a smarter person. And if you guys are interested, I will post a video on my channel afterwards about what my post Jerome Powell presser.
Those are always a must watch, Joseph. I love those snippets. Last bear.
Yeah, I would just, I'm looking back towards last year and just getting deja vu on this same situation where a growth scare sort of came through in late summer, rate cuts happened, then everything sort of back, and we saw a pretty substantial actual rise in yields coming out of a big rate cut decision in September of last year, where they cut 50 basis points. So obviously, so far, most of the yield curve has been trending significantly down over the past 2 months, 10 years now under 4%. But to the extent that folks have mentioned earlier on the panel, that we see a little bit stronger consumer bounce back from some weakness earlier this year, and just overall concerns around inflation and you know, the stickiness thereof, tariffs starting to come in, that we could see those, you know, bond yields sort of reprice in sort of a counterintuitive measure like what we did last year. I'll leave it at that. Thanks, guys. It's always a pleasure.
Pleasure's always mine, Last Bear. Martin, glad to have you back. Any closing thoughts, something to plug?
Yeah, a couple things. So I think we gotta remember, don't fight the Fed. I know it's a cliche, but it's so true, especially influenced so heavily by the existing government. You have U.S. midterms coming up in almost a year from now, and all intent is to make sure markets stay high and continue rocketing from now until then. So enjoy the move upwards that that we'll see. But use it as a time to add some hedging. It's always good to add insurance when it's cheap and premiums are really low. You can check out my Twitter. I got some exciting news. I signed a book contract 2 weeks ago. I'm launching publishing a new book, Investing Through the Storms. So stay tuned for that in the coming months.
Definitely be on the lookout there. Martin, congratulations. Johnny, any last thoughts before we kick the audio over to the presser for the listeners?
Just say I agree with what Martin said. You don't want to try fighting the Fed, not the way things are at the moment. We may disagree that the correct policy path is an aggressive string of rate cuts, but it looks like that's what we're going to get. Don't fight the Fed. And Joseph, I just want to say to you, I do love your show. It's my Sunday morning YouTube watch. Thanks for giving Europe and the UK a mention last week. And if you want to follow me, just check out my website, super-macro.com. Or find me on Twitter, super_macro.
Every single one of these folks is a gem when it comes to keeping sane when you're like me and don't really have a full grasp on what the hell's going on every day.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by outsourcing around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. So when you buy from American Giant, you're taking a stand for hardworking people, local communities, and quality clothes. American Giant directly supports American manufacturers and ensures you aren't footing that tariff bill. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.